Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is Reza Marashi. He used to work in the State Department. Now he's at NIAC, NIACouncil.org. It's the National Iranian American Council. And they work to promote peace and good relations between that state and this one. Welcome back to the show, Reza. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me back.
So what's the good word?
Oh, the good word, if we're talking about my issue, is U.S.-Iran relations more generally. More specifically is that there was a positive round of negotiations between Iran and the permanent members of the U.N. Security Council plus Germany. The reason why they were positive is two key reasons. Well, let's just cut to the chase. One, for the Iranians and both the Americans moved a little bit further towards the middle, if you will. They both compromised. And to date, when one side's been willing to compromise, the other side really hasn't been. What does that mean? That means that the American side, together with the European allies, decided to have conversations with the Iranians about what this all might look like at the end of the negotiation process. Up to this date, the Bush administration before and the Obama administration currently has so far avoided those kinds of conversations, and that made the Iranians very skittish for a whole host of reasons. But then the Iranians themselves were also much more forthcoming about the details of their nuclear program and what they might be willing to do in terms of limitations on their program and what they might expect in return. They were much more concrete. All of this is very positive. It injects momentum into the diplomatic process. That doesn't mean that the problem can be solved overnight, but it does mean that we're finally getting down to business in a way that I don't think we've seen over the past 4 to 5 years. Mm-hmm.
So in other words, the Iranian chamberlains are doing their best to appease the American aggressor.
No, it's actually quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. The approach that hardliners and extremists both in Tehran and in Washington have taken up to date has only exacerbated the conflict, and it's made sanctions increase on Iran more and more when Iranian hardliners did extremist-type activities. And it's made Iran's nuclear program advance technologically, creating new facts on the ground as American hardliners and extremists put more and more pressure on. So this cycle of escalation has created an incentive for both sides to walk back from the brink of a military confrontation that I think they'd independently seek to avoid.
Yeah. All right, so now, I guess, can you give us the word from Geneva about, I mean, I guess they're saying everybody's getting along just great. Can you tell us, you know, how far it is that, I don't really understand all the ins and outs of all this diplomacy stuff. They've certainly come a lot further than just agreeing to have some talks, but they haven't really shaken hands on even the outline of the deal yet, really, have they?
Well, that's what they've been getting down to for the first time in a long time, is the outlines of what a deal might look like. You know, both sides agreed to not leak details of the negotiations to the press, but what we've been able to gather so far from people in Geneva that were there during the negotiations, not in the room, but were there to talk to the negotiators after the fact, is that, you know, there was a willingness to compromise on core issues and have very frank discussions about these kinds of core issues that neither side was really willing to have prior, before it turned into a blame game where, you know, the Americans blame the Iranians blame the Americans.
Right.
But now, they, you know, both sides have kind of said, okay, enough's enough. Let's see what we can do. The reason why that's important is because when you're actually talking about the core issues that need to be discussed in order to resolve the conflict, then we're really going to be giving diplomacy the chance that it deserves. Then that we're actually taking steps to check the box. For example, in ways that we didn't in the run-up to the Iraq War, and some might even say the war in Afghanistan or NATO's invasion of Libya.
Right.
So doing this kind of due diligence is critical. And if it continues, both the Iranians and the Americans deserve praise for what happened today. And if it continues, then we should continue to praise them for taking the proper steps to find a peaceful solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's more or less what Greg Thielman wrote this morning, or maybe yesterday, that I read. focusing more on the Iranians' lack of bluster and blame and, you know, like not pointing out inconvenient things like Israeli assassinations of their scientists and that kind of stuff, which I guess the way he put it, they were focusing really on talking with each other rather than on posturing for the external audience, that is really the key.
Yeah, I think so. I think what we're seeing now is the fact that Iran has politics, and you have a new president in Iran who has brought in a new cabinet to staff the various positions in different ministries. And these people have a different idea on how diplomacy should work and a different way that they prefer to interact with the world as representatives of the Iranian government. That doesn't mean that problems can be solved overnight, but it does mean that it makes it a little bit easier for the process to move forward. It also makes it easier for the United States to move forward with the diplomatic process in ways that, frankly, it hasn't prior to these most recent talks. It's going to be very interesting to see how this process moves forward because both sides, you know, just because the extremists on both sides have been boxed in, it doesn't mean they've gone away. And I think American negotiators and Iranian negotiators are well aware of the fact that they could potentially rear their ugly heads at any given time. So they're going to have to continue to be brave and take risks for peace. That's going to be critical going forward.
Right. Yeah. Move quickly. Well, so now, I mean, the bottom line on the American side, because isn't it correct that everybody in the whole world who's interested in the subject already knows the outline of the deal? It's basically the same one that Obama offered him back in 2009 that Brazil and Turkey worked in 2010. It's, you know, doesn't have to be exact, but more or less stop enriching to 20%, sign the additional protocol, but that would require the Americans recognizing, at least de facto, if not officially stating it this way, it would mean them recognizing Iran's right to enrich uranium and leave the Natanz facility at least open for business and enriching uranium for their nuclear reactor, for their electricity program. And for the long term, which I don't know if that would mean they'd have to just ignore their own Security Council resolution on the issue or repeal it or what, but that's the only real question here, right? Is, are the Americans willing to go ahead and recognize civilian enrichment at 3.6%? Because I think the Iranians have been willing to make this deal all along, pretty much, at least since Obama came to power here.
I think you're raising really important points, and everything that you said is going to be a core tenet of what any confidence-building measure or final deal, frankly, would end up looking like. The only thing I would tack on the back end of what you just said is that the Iranians want to go a few steps further than everything that you outlined and say, where is this all going? Where is this leading? What kind of relationship do you want to have if we make this kind of deal? Because what the Iranians aren't interested in is making the kind of compromises that we're asking them to make, and then we, of course, make a few compromises in return. But the relationship continues to be negative, and there continues to be this U.S.-Iran Cold War, if you will. They want this to lead somewhere so that the overall relationship goes to a better place, not just the conflict over the nuclear program. And that's what's most critical, because if we don't use this as a springboard to have that kind of conversation about what the end game looks like, what does this all mean and where is it all going, like, it's like the old saying goes, if you don't know where you're going, any road can take you there. And that's very dangerous in diplomacy. So everything that you said about the technical details of Iran's program, everything that you said about what the United States would have to be willing to accept as it pertains to what Iran's program will look like, the technical details, the level of enrichment, number of centrifuges, you name it, across the board, inspections, verifications, all that stuff, 100% has to be there. But also we have to know where the overall relationship between the U.S. and Iran is going. You know, we can't be negotiating with Iran on the one hand and trying to overthrow the government on the other hand, right? We're going to have to make a firm decision on what we want. And frankly, so do the Iranians. So that's the most optimistic thing that's emerged from Geneva so far, is they've finally started to have that kind of conversation.
Do you think the Iranians would settle for, we'll give you a real and serious nuclear deal, but we're going to still threaten you all the time, but just ignore it?
No,
that kind of thing?
No, I don't think the Iranians would accept that. And I can't tell
you
that.
Because, look, I want a permanent peace here. You know me. I want to.
Absolutely.
I think that even from the point of view of the empire, the number one most important thing on the agenda ought to be to befriend the most important Shia power on earth right now, whatever. Even from bad guy American imperialist point of view, that's my point of view, is make peace with Iran yesterday. But I'm wondering, you know, if they would settle for, we're not going to have too much of a future, but at least we're not going to have the nuclear issue to beat you over the head with anymore. And we'll only beat you over the head over Hezbollah and smaller stuff, you know? I don't know.
That's an excellent question, and that's the kind of stuff that the Iranians want to talk about as it pertains to what's the end game? What does this all look like when everything's been negotiated? They want to negotiate on things not only limited to the nuclear program. They want to talk about regional security, so that includes Hamas and Hezbollah. That includes Afghanistan. That includes Iraq. That includes Syria. They want to expand the agenda and expand the horizons. They understand, though, and I think the United States understands as well, that the nuclear issue is probably the most pressing issue. So if we make some progress on that and de-escalate tensions in that realm, then it opens up the possibility to take momentum from those negotiations and apply that momentum to talks over these other issues. And that's how you create real and lasting peace. So that's really the most positive thing that's come so far from these talks. They scheduled a new round of talks to follow up. I believe it's November 7th and 8th or 6th and 7th. Basically, it's 3 weeks' time. And that's good, because what that allows both sides to do is to come back to their respective capitals, go over what was discussed, and then follow up with more concrete ideas and more concrete counterproposals. And that's the magic of diplomacy.
That's funny. All right, well, so it seems like if Barack Obama really wants to try to do this, and he's really telling John Kerry that, like, hell yeah, we got to see this thing through kind of a thing, the worst he has to deal with is John McCain and Bill Kristol, and he can handle them if he really wants to try. That's our hardliners, right? But what about the Iranian hardliners? How tough is it? And you can disagree with what I just said, by the way, all you feel like, by the way. Say whatever you want. But I'm more interested in who are the Iranian hardliners, and how difficult is it for Rouhani to do what he's doing, considering their domestic politics?
Oh, it's certainly going to be difficult. And we should understand that, and we should walk into these negotiations with Iran clear-eyed about the fact that Rouhani, the president of Iran, is handling his hawks, but he hasn't gotten rid of them. I think what's important to realize is that there's never been this much unity inside Iran's political system about pursuing negotiations with the United States and taking steps to improve the overall relationship. When I say unity, I don't mean 100% unity. But there's never been this much cohesion in the Iranian political system, really since 1979. Iran's politics have always been very, very factional, and different factions have always been attacking one another to try and get credit for any kind of improvement with Iran's relations with the outside world. And frankly, some Iranian political factions are opposed to improving relations with the outside world because they thrive in isolation. Thankfully, Iranian extremists have been sidelined, perhaps only temporarily, but sidelined. But there are key conservative factions and key conservative politicians inside of Iran, including the leader himself, Mr. Ali Khamenei, that are so far backing President Rouhani's initiatives vis-a-vis the United States. So it's very difficult to torpedo the process, but not impossible, if the leader himself is backing it. So the quicker that the Iranians can make progress in the negotiations, and the quicker that they can deliver something tangible, the more political space they'll have to continue to pursue this path. And I think that's why they're trying to move quickly.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, remind me, back a few months ago when Rouhani was elected, he was not the guy that the Supreme Leader preferred at the time, correct?
By most accounts, no. The leader himself always says that I don't have a preferred candidate, but I think most Iran analysts would tell you that his preferred candidate probably was the most hardline candidate of the handful that were approved to run. But the individual who ended up winning was Rouhani, who ran as a more moderate and more pragmatic. And I use these terms, moderate and pragmatic, relative sure. to the people he was running against. You know, a moderate in the United States is very different than a moderate in Iran. But the Iranian people went to the polls overwhelmingly and voted for this guy. So much so that I think the leader himself and other conservative politicians in Iran who maybe don't want the diplomatic process to move forward and improve were forced to accept the results and give them a chance. Because any authoritarian government is always going to be concerned that the disconnect between the government and the people becomes irreparable. And because of the post-election crisis in 2009 in Iran, never really got resolved. 4 years later, people went to the polls and voted overwhelmingly. I am personally of the opinion that hardliners in Iran realized that, you know, they could do some funny business with the elections once, but they couldn't get away with it twice.
Right. And now, back when, let's see, in 2003, Rouhani played some role in the so-called golden offer. Well, that's what Gordon Prather called it. I don't know if there's a popular term for it, but it was the Iranian great peace offer that said, hey, we'll deal our entire nuclear program, but we'll also deal with you on issues of Hezbollah, on issues of energy and whatever you want. Let's be friends kind of a thing. And that was the one where even the Swiss diplomat that delivered the peace offer got in trouble over it. And the Gareth Porter broke the story with the Leverett's as his, well, I guess it was Leverett and Mann then as his sources. So anyway, I was just wondering if you could remind us, what was Rouhani's role there? And was it Khatami or it was Rafsanjani was the president? It was Khatami at the time was the president, right?
That's right. It was Khatami who was the president. Rouhani was the chief nuclear negotiator at the time. This is 10 years ago, by the way, that they put forward a document that expressed a willingness to discuss everything from Iraq to the nuclear program to terrorism, regional security, essentially every single thing that the U.S. government says we have a problem with the Iranians because they do this. The Iranians submitted a document and said, okay, we're willing to talk to you about it. And not only did they say we're willing to talk to you about the things that you don't like that we do, here's a list of stuff that we'd like to talk to you about that you do that we don't like. and frankly, that's how diplomacy works. And Rouhani was actually leading the nuclear negotiations at the time, which were separate from this grand bargain offer, if you will. But what's important to remember is that Rouhani and Zarif, Javad Zarif, who is the foreign minister of Iran currently, he was the UN ambassador at the time, 10, 11 years ago. These two men were two of the critical actors that spearheaded both processes at the time, both processes being the grand bargain offer, and then the separate process of negotiating with the European Union. Rouhani was leading those negotiations. So not only did the Bush administration refused the grand bargain offer that the Iranians put forward, they also refused to accept a very reasonable agreement on Iran's nuclear program that the European Union negotiated with Rouhani at the time.
Yeah.
And if we look back at what the Iranians agreed to, it's far more minimal in terms of what their actual nuclear program would look like in terms of technology and substance than what we're going to end up having to live with today.
Sure. Yeah, Natanz wasn't even a hole in the ground in 2003.
Yeah, so, you know, they were asking for a handful of centrifuges and enrichment on Iranian soil. That's what they were asking for in 2003. That's the essence of it, you know, give or take a few things here or there. It's going to be a lot more than that today. The price that we're going to have to pay for a peaceful solution to Iran's nuclear program has increased exponentially over the past 10 to 11 years, largely, but not entirely, but largely because of the Bush administration's unwillingness to accept what the Europeans were able to negotiate with Iran at that time. And this isn't my opinion. The former foreign minister of the UK and another former European foreign ministers are on the record saying all of this.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's past is prologue, as Shakespeare used to say. And we need to understand who we're dealing with at the other side of the negotiating table. And who we're dealing with now is somebody who's tried to do this before there were any of these sanctions on oil and gas and banking, right? Before there was any of this pressure. So he has a demonstrated track record of wanting to do this. And he has the backing of key hardliners in Iran. So if we can't do it now with these guys, I question whether or not we really are interested in doing it.
Yeah. Well, you know, whatever else is true about the regime there, same with Assad in Syria and Gaddafi in Libya. They were useful allies in fighting al-Qaeda. And those are America's actual enemies. All Iran ever did to America is declare independence. Al-Qaeda attacked and killed 3,000 people, and that was after trying to sink one of our ships and bombing two of our embassies and bombing the barracks at Khobar Towers. Those are our actual enemies, and we're willing to support, if not outright support them, at least ship guns and money that end up in their hands as they fight a war in Syria now because the Syrian government is an ally of Iran. And we're actually backing our own enemies against Iran and its allies The only reason I can think of, obviously there's resentment over the Declaration of Independence of 79, but really it's because of Israel. Israel's concerned about Hezbollah, and Syria and Iran back Hezbollah, and Iran backs Hezbollah by way of Syria. And so since we didn't take them up on their golden offer where they were willing to deal with Hezbollah and force Hezbollah to become a political party without guns anymore, I guess we have to back al-Qaeda in Syria now. I mean, this is the kind of mess that we get in for turning these opportunities down. And in fact, one more thing about this real quick, and then I'll shut up and you can say what you want about it, is that at the time of the golden offer, one of the things in there was, and we'll deal with you, we'll work together on Iraq. Well, what did America do? America didn't just fight a war for the Shiites in Iraq and to hand them the capital city, but specifically the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, Abdulaziz al-Hakim, who was the hand-picked leader of Sistani and Khomeini. This is the guy that they wanted Bush to put in power, and Bush tried to put him and his men in power as best he could, and the only thing that happened was Hakim ended up dying, and Sadr and his allies ended up, and the Dawa Party ended up inheriting a bit more of the power. But basically, George Bush's entire Iraq war project was to do exactly what the Ayatollah, I mean, specifically what the Ayatollah Khomeini wanted him to do as far as the Supreme Islamic Council, etc., and yet wouldn't work with him on it at all. And so it was a complete disaster, and almost a million people died.
I think that the Bush administration strategically made so many mistakes in the Middle East from beginning to end. And the Obama administration has continued a lot of them, I'll be the first to admit. But I want to give the Obama administration credit now because they've taken a few steps. We should acknowledge good behavior. We should reinforce good behavior, right, when we see it from our political leaders. And I think Barack Obama and John Kerry and Chuck Hagel are three men who genuinely want to solve this peacefully. I disagree with some of the ways they've gone about it over the past 5 years, but I think their bottom line is the same as you and mine. If it doesn't get solved, at the end of the day, we're going to have to look very carefully at what mucked up the process. But the fact that they're trying and they're willing to talk about an end game with the Iranians, about what the relationship will look like at the end, provides the opportunity, far from guaranteed, but an opportunity, the first time in decades, to maybe move away from some of the stuff that you were just talking about how America strategically makes mistakes in the Middle East, and perhaps get it right. Far be it from making promises that that's going to be the case, because I understand how difficult it is, but if we have a window of opportunity and our political leaders are pursuing it, then we should reinforce that good behavior and let them know that as American citizens, we're the majority. The people that support them in using diplomacy and peaceful methods, we're the majority, and we have their back. So hopefully this will continue, but your concerns are warranted because the historical reference points that you just made, I mean, you know, it's there. It happened. And until we start to act a little bit differently in that part of the world, I don't see how we're going to be able to change the paradigm.
Well, you know, I certainly agree with you that, well, you could never get me to praise a president, but I certainly am able to recognize that if it had been McCain or Romney in this situation, they wouldn't be talking with the Iranians like this at all. They would be both much worse on this. So, you know, it could be worse. If that's not the highest praise, it's the best they'll get out of me. But no, I mean, this is a real big deal. And honestly, you know, I can tell that, you know, the Saudis want what they want. And the arms dealers probably prefer that the Saudis are afraid of the Iranians. And, of course, the Israelis are afraid of a single atom of uranium existing anywhere in Persia, you know, at any time and that kind of thing. But other than that, it doesn't seem like there's any real purpose in America's Cold War with Iran other than a grudge from when I was too young, you know, when I was in preschool. You know what I mean? It's ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people would agree with you that it's reached the point of ridiculousness. It's long since. We're way past the point of ridiculous in terms of the U.S.-Iran relationship, and both sides deserve blame for poisoning the well. You know, one goes, sure, then the next goes. A lot of people have made their careers out of proving how nasty they can be to the other side. But I think now where we're at is we have an opportunity to move away from that. And the best way to move away from that, and frankly, I would argue personally, the only way to move away from that is courageous leaders that are willing to take risks for peace. If you look at this part of the world more specifically, the Middle East, and the world more generally, things aren't going so well, not just for the United States, but for a lot of countries. It's going to be very tough for Barack Obama to get a foreign policy win. Iran provides a possibility. They've aligned themselves for a deal. And I would hope that the president of the United States would use the same kind of political fortitude to push back against the Congress and other extremists to at least see if it's possible, to probe and test this possibility. So far, so good, but it's going to take a lot more of what we've seen through this week.
Yep. Well, it's interesting, the discrepancy between the polls of the masses of Americans. I think it was 75% said that they are in support of these talks, and then still the squeaky wheels up there are still squeaking. So you're right. It's going to take the Americans making their voices heard that we support the president's position on this. And no matter what you think of the healthcare thing, you got to, and Obama because of it or whatever, you still got to support these peace talks with Iran no matter what. And let them know that. That's my
yeah, opinion. Absolutely. No, I agree. You know, if you're not backing peace talks, then the real question is, what are you backing?
Right.
And that's an inconvenient question that a lot of people like to dance around or just outright ignore.
Yep. Hey, even Rand Paul, while calling for more sanctions somehow, is saying, let's make this deal, or let's make some... He's saying something about let's negotiate. I don't know what, but I'll take it, you know?
I'll take it, too.
Hey, thanks very much for your time again on the show, Reza. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
All right, everybody. That's Reza Marashi. He's a former State Department guy. And now at the NIAC, that's NIACouncil.org, NIACouncil.org, working for peace between America and Iran. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here.